that pursuit of doing something different. At each position that I had, I always wanted to do something slightly different than what was already being done. And early on, that shows up in some organizations as you're a pain. You're difficult. Why can't you just sell what we already have or make what we already have? But if I'd had the confidence that it would work out the way that it would at an earlier age, I probably would have pursued it with more passion early on.
Welcome to Breaking Down Boxes. I'm Gene Marino with Acres Packaging.
And I'm Joe Morelli with Houston Patterson and Lewisburg Printing Company.
We have compelling conversations with successful entrepreneurs in the packaging space.
We are welcoming back Richard Brown, president and co-owner from The Box Maker, from part two. So really excited to dig into more of Richard's story today. This podcast is brought to you by Oxbox.
It always surprises me that the question, what do we do better than anyone else, doesn't get more attention. Or maybe a better question is, what do our customers think we do better than anyone else? While it's not sexy, the answer for Oxbox is jumbo and heavy-duty box manufacturing. With best-in-class capabilities, products, and service, Oxbox really is the best choice if you need big, durable boxes. Oxbox is strength you can depend on.
Check them out at www.oxbox.com. Now, back to the show.
How did the Davids come together to start The Box Maker?
Dave Hill had worked at Boise as the manager of the Wallula box plant. And he wanted to leave the big company and start a sheet plant of his own. And Dave Taylor was a customer of his at a large potato and French fry producer. And so they knew each other through that relationship. Hill had asked Taylor if he wanted to invest, and would have been 1980. They started the company in 81. And originally, Dave Taylor was not the second partner. There was another gentleman who Taylor had introduced to Hill that came in. And the way I understand it, like within 3 months, that guy had something happen and he really needed the funds back. So Taylor then came in and that guy could exit. And the relationship in the early years, for many years, in fact, was that Dave Taylor was largely a silent partner. He did the books and they consulted together on any big decisions. Like they started doing acquisition pretty early. So they would get together for those types of things. But Dave Hill was running the day-to-day since that was really his area of experience. And also, the business wasn't big enough to support both of them at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it was probably barely big enough to support one. We started having fun right away. Business started growing, and then they started investing. New equipment started coming like 2 years into my tenure there. And continued for quite some time.
When you come in the door, did they demote that other corrugated sales manager? Did they terminate him? How many people were reporting to you?
The prior corrugated sales manager, he went into sales and continued to work for the company for some time. And I drew on his expertise at times because he had a lot of it. And then I managed three people directly, the design manager, the customer service manager for corrugated, and the estimator. And I guess in total, I probably had 7 or 8 people that were in my part of the organization. And that was pretty consistent until, I think, 2007. So I started in 2003, and then 4 years later, I started to get more responsibility.
In those initial 3, 6, 9 months upon having those new people around you, what were some of the things you might have done to earn their trust? You mentioned leaning on the former manager and listening to him. Are there other things that you can maybe recommend to people that move into a new management role to set the table for long-term success?
I think that started with, I did an exit conversation with my team at Landsberg. So I had 5 direct reports at Landsberg Seattle who had been with me for a while. And I ended up getting some feedback out of that I was really surprised by. The primary thing was that they didn't feel like I handed off the critical projects, like I would keep the key work for myself. And that was not an awareness that I had. So I took that with me to the new job. I tried to focus right away on involving people in key projects and making sure that I had them participate and know that they were participating early. I also had a situation where, you know, the prior manager for most of these people was Dave Hill. So they were used to that owner relationship. And that took some time where I had to be trusted by them in the way that they had trusted him. And he helped guide me. We would have conversations just about when you were working with this person, what do you recommend? What's their style? That kind of thing. And mostly, Joe, I just figured if I could try not to shake the snow globe so much in the beginning and get some successes going, people would start to buy into, okay, this guy might actually have something to bring to the company, and then we can rally behind him. I also remember specifically, I made a point that design was a critical asset for us. And design was important, you could tell, but I don't think that it had ever been stated openly to the sales force and the rest of the company that, like, we're going to win on design. And so I really involved Peter and Darren, the two designers at that time, in being motivated to be part of the success, to do something different with the packaging so that we could be an innovative player and frankly, then drive some value, right? Not just me too.
Corrugated sales manager, vice president, general manager, president. What was that pathway like? How you build this significant level of trust and business pivot and stuff like that, I think is pretty important.
The corrugated sales manager's job, put everything into it that I knew from the past. And mostly what that means is I got out in the car and I started riding with salespeople. I was side by side with them on a regular basis in prospects, in existing accounts. What can we do differently? What can we do better? How can we improve on what already exists? And Mr. Hill had an adage, do something different, which really fit with the way that I liked to operate. I was always trying to sell something that was an improvement or an innovation on what existed already that had carried from my Masterbox days through Richter and on. And I had a lot of fun. It was a great sales team to work with. They, for the most part, they were very open to having me work with them. And it's like any other team, I think, as soon as success starts happening, others want to participate in that. So I had some early successes with our sales team in Eugene, Oregon. And that corrugated business continued to grow rapidly. So I started in 2003. By 2005, we needed a new flexifolder gluer. We bought a 37-inch McKinley. I often tell people it's the last McKinley. It was unfortunate that McKinley went out of business shortly after the installation, but we got about two-thirds of a machine. And luckily, the Landsberg organization had a 37-inch McKinley at Mercury. So I was able to have my team visit often to learn which components were missing and buy them and put them in. And then in 2007, we installed a Ward 66-inch flexifolder gluer. So the two primary machines were already being upgraded because of the volume gains. The corrugated business on a volume basis, I think, doubled within 2 to 2.5 years. And we were pushing 18, 20 million square feet through the building on a regular basis, almost all brown box. And in 2007, Dave and Dave asked me if I would want to take on some additional responsibility, primarily the distribution part of our business. So corrugated was the biggest part of the business already. From a revenue standpoint, it was like 35%. And then distribution was the next biggest piece, probably about 30% at that time. And again, just a good fit with my experience. And so I started taking that on. And it was around that time that I think we put together a phantom equity arrangement where I would basically have a tracking share, if you will, on the same valuation basis that they used for themselves. Dave and Dave had a pretty simple buy-sell agreement in place that valued the company on specific metrics from the past 3 years, plus some calculation of asset. And so I started getting a statement of my contributions and what they equaled in phantom shares. And that would track along every year I would get a statement. So this is 2007. 08, 09 come. Great Recession. I had to go to them and ask if I was going to have to write a check for my equity value that went down to a negative number. So I remember having to ask some questions early on just about the ownership side of it. And the business was really challenged because I think, Gene, this goes to the conversation about digital. We found out in the recession how big our exposure was to one or two industries.
There's a lot of positive upward success. You come on board in this sales management role and you're showing growth. Growth to the point where they can buy some new equipment. You give us some numbers about where the business led to. But these guys obviously think a lot of you and your skill set. You talk about how Dave Taylor's a silent partner, but focused a little more on the finance. He comes into the business, finance, accounting, label, foam, and what Mr. Hill was doing, but they're not just looking at you saying, hey, good morning, take over all the branches on the distribution side. Are they starting to paint a vision for you, or it's a little more nuanced and mindful as what's going on in the present? Hey, take this on. We want to give you some added responsibility. Is it the latter more than the former?
Yeah, it's the latter. Yeah. And I forget when it happened, but there was a point in my time with them where I asked them if I could do something. And they said, yeah, we've been waiting for you to ask if you could do that. And I'm like, what? I thought you didn't want me to do it. And like, I was holding off. And they said, no, we've just been waiting for you to ask. And that was a light bulb moment for me. Oh, maybe I should ask sooner. Maybe not all of my requests at once now, but I'm going to come with a few more things more often. But that's how it was. They were happy with what I was doing. We would have conversations about it. We never really talked in any significant way about what was next until we got into, I don't know, closer to 2013, 14. That's when we really started to talk about, okay, succession. 2009, I became vice president and general manager. They surprised me with the vice president title. I had asked if I could become general manager. And then the recession came. Everything starts to evolve because 20-some percent of our business seemingly evaporated overnight. That kind of leads into the next phase of the business, and really the big evolution where we go from a brown box and supplies focused company to digital, what becomes a high graphics business, a lot of software investment. It's a technology company now that just in addition happens to do packaging. So that all starts there in 2010.
How does it take us back to 2010 and how you're finding your way into these new kind of substrate or process segments of the industry?
Yeah, we had tried a couple of times to be part of a sheet feeder. The Pacific Northwest is a relatively small market, 600 miles away from any other major market. And unfortunately, there just wasn't enough volume with a few friends to create another sheet feeder. So that opportunity to participate in the vertical margin and continue to be competitive in brown box was also going away. We were a buyer, a million, maybe $2 million a year in litholam. And we had never put any real assets in to do litholam in-house. Even our die cutter really wasn't great for taking in top sheet lam and finishing it in the plant. So it was pretty much a complete buyout. We would purchase it and then just make a margin on it as a distributor. But we started thinking about, should we start making that in-house? Should we buy a laminator and a better die cutter and, you know, start to go after that market? And I had been to a couple of signage trade shows and seen digital presses for the sign industry. And I don't know why, but I was convinced that had potential for corrugated and that at some point it would become efficient enough that you could directly post print digital ink on a box and not have all the costs and the waste of lamination. And so I started to investigate that more. I eventually found John Tatum at Heritage in the Bay Area, California. We were at an event that was unrelated. John and I are describing our businesses, and I've got foam and distribution, and he's got this. And we're just having a laugh about the diversity of the two and how similar they are. And then he asks something like, what are you thinking about doing next? And I said, well, I have this harebrained idea about digital press applications for corrugated. And John says, really? You should come to my plant. And I said, why is that? He says, I've got one. There was a day-to-day operating facility with what I was thinking about doing, and I hadn't encountered one yet. And I was very early for John as well. So I did. I took a flight almost immediately down there to chat with them and came back. And I pitched Dave and Dave on a $135,000 investment in an HP signage press. It was really quick. I don't think I had a good business case for it at the time, but they agreed that we could make that investment. We put it in the design space with next to the Kongsberg table. And I remember that was a delightful conversation telling the designers that we were going to use their table for production. And so we had a true one-piece flow. You could print one sheet and then flip it over and cut it. We would let the designers move in occasionally and make a sample. But that was the beginning. It could print 6 to 8 sheets an hour, Gene. And it was not fast. We didn't tell anybody that it took 30 hours to print their small order. It wasn't like that. But it did work really well for the things that we thought it would work well for. Header cards, pallet skirts, somebody who wants a short run of counter displays. And we had had this experience so many times selling corrugated where you go to a prospector, they come in and they want to have a counter display. And they have this $5 price point in mind. It's always $5. I never found that it was anything other than $5. And I say, okay, I can get you counter displays for $5. It's going to be 1,000 of them, plus or minus 10%. I'm going to have $2,500 in tooling and then $2,500 in boxes. And that's going to equate to $5 each. And it's going to look, and you'd say this kind of tongue in cheek, it's going to look beautiful. It's a 40-some line screen, two-color flexo with a big heavy trap between your art. Or on a good day, we might get them within a 16th of an inch, and you won't notice that your orange is black. But man, with digital, we could talk to those people and say, you're going to a trade show? You're trying to launch this product? Yeah. How many do you need for the show? I don't know. I probably need 10. Okay. Do you want them all to look the same? Or can I run different languages, different color schemes? Do you have different art from your graphics people? Are you focused on a couple of different retailers and we could do different put up for each retailer? And it's just a totally different conversation. You might charge $25 each, but they have nothing to throw away when they get back from the show, because that's what would happen. In the Flexo world, I'd run that 1,000 for them plus or minus, and then they'd come back from the show and they're all excited. They got 3 retail channels. But none of them want the counter display that we already ran. And we need to do a different put up or a different art. And you do it all over again, right? Sell them tooling again, and then you run the box again. Digital, you just give them what they want. And then Taylor calls it the gateway drug to bigger orders. But we bought the press at the end of 2010. And so really the business of selling digital corrugated began in 2011.
Looking at those sales reps, hey. Check this fancy 6 sheets an hour dynamo we got over here. Go sell this. Did they comprehend? It's not like you can go out and get a 10,000 quantity.
No. I think you could sum up the early years of digital with the word close. It's close to the print quality that the customer wants. It's close to the pricing that they want. It's going to be close to the lead time that they're looking for. Everything came down to this word close, but it was sellable. And I think I had 2 reps that were really primarily interested in selling it. And they had some customers that either did retail packaging or display, and they needed short runs. And so it started out with that.
You said it was close to sellable. It was close to all those things. Was it close to profitable?
No, it probably wasn't profitable, especially given the time that went into it.
Yeah.
Just there were no processes. We were very fortunate because we had a label business. So we had a graphics department, and that was such a key advantage, because if I had to also build a graphics capability within the company, I'm not sure that I would have been able to do that. or that Dave and Dave would have been on for that additional salary. But we were able to take that graphics capability. You're basically just dealing with a larger format and file. And that group did a nice job right away of learning what we needed in order to create a good product digitally. And no, by 2013, the business was just a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And so even at that time, I'm not sure, Joe, that it would have had any real profit to it, just based on the amount of resources that were going into trying to sell it.
You were one of the early adopters. And with the original HP that you put in, the 6 to 8 sheets an hour that you mentioned, that was, you were an early adopter there. But then in my mind, you made an even bigger leap when you went into the high-speed world. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you were one of the early adopters in that aspect of digital print as well, in terms of printing on corrugated with the purchase of the PageWide.
Yeah, we're on our fourth generation of printing, we like to describe. We went from that FB700 at 6 to 8 sheets an hour. We did an FB7600 flatbed, that is multi-pass machine, at roughly 40 sheets an hour. Then a HP17000. We might have averaged 120 some sheets an hour. These are 5x8 sheets usually. And then we were very early with the C500 page wide. Dave and I actually held what we understood to be the first US slot. We decided to try and work our way down. We didn't have quite the appetite for being first on a new device that significant. So we kept trying to work our way down, but other people kept dropping in position two for other reasons, this timing of their building being ready or other things. And so we ended up being third in the US. Chief in Atlanta got theirs. A few weeks later, Company Box in Charlotte, and then us. And we were the original three in the US for a period of time. And I'm very thankful to Aaron at Chief and Louis at Company Box, because they shared an awful lot of information about their install experience and their early operating experience. Louis is a personal friend. We talk often about the business. We're now the only ones with two of these things. So we're equally minded in that sense that we've done it again. He's got two in one building. I've got one in Northwest Arkansas and then one in Seattle. And yeah, that was a huge leap.
Touch on real quick. That's a substantial investment. You talk about $135,000 for the original, and it's a big purchase to go after one of these page wides. So is that, obviously the risk level has also really jumped up. Explain the conversations with Dave. How did that all go down?
In my time with them, what I had always seen, it started with that first Flexo purchase. If you build the business to a point where there's a decision to make about adding capacity, all I had ever seen them do was add capacity. They were more than happy to invest in chasing growth or fueling growth. And for Dave Taylor and myself, Mr. Hill having passed away a few years ago, it's still very much that way. The leaps are much bigger now. They're much more intense from a capital and organizational standpoint to add something like a C500. But it seemed like the next logical decision along a progression of consistent growth. The demand was there. We could see where in some of these peak seasons, between the web to print business and our traditional business for digital, through the sales team, we would leave the holiday season with thousands of orders late and unfulfilled. You could not have enough capacity. It was just, and we would upset so many customers, because it's just, there's only so much speed that you can get out of one of these multi-pass machines and a bunch of CAD tables, right? Even when the CAD tables are robotic, you're still only going to get so much product off every hour. And on the Flexo plant, if we lose an hour, usually the operator has the sense to speed things up for the balance of the day and you get back on schedule. With a digital press, there's only one speed, at least for most of the single pass arena. And so you lose an hour, it's gone. There's no making it run faster for the balance of the day. We were just really intent on growing the capacity to continue to fuel the business. Dave Taylor likes to describe it like a staircase. Capacity is a series of stairs. Sales only reaches the optimal position of your capacity at the edge of the stairs. And then you either have too much or too little. Right now we have way too much because we just did a doubling of the digital capacity. But we're starting to see, we're at a point now where a year and a half into operating the second C500 in Arkansas, we now have consistent volume that one C500 could not keep up with. We end up looking a little bit smarter right now because thankfully there's enough volume that it makes sense to have two.
Clearly, you guys saw something. You're now on iteration 4 of these machines mm-hmm. and have progressively invested more and more money into it. So at some point, there had to be a time where you guys looked at each other and said, maybe this isn't making us a ton of money, but that's where the future is for our company. How did that conversation go? And was it difficult to look at these guys and say, look, we're not making money, but let's spend more money to go after more of this work?
It was a difficult conversation at times. I remember asking them to invest over $1 million in a new press that would run, I think, 30 sheets an hour. So really, let's just really go in big. It was a next generation press. I think there was a demo press. That was the reason that it was at that price point. We could pick that up. And I got turned down. There wasn't a good business case at the time, and they weren't into the Kool-Aid as deeply at that moment. But I had been invited to HP. They had an experience center outside of Atlanta in Alpharetta. And so I had seen firsthand a lot of these presses, equipment that I had not seen at any show or any other event. Now I'm there. They've got Indigo presses running commercial. They're running folding cartons. There's some flexibles. Ton of signage. And it's HP did an amazing job with this facility. You could not go and visit without being encouraged about what these machines were capable of, right? And so I was really starting to feel like this is definitely the future of the business. And so one of the times that I'm there, I start reading one of these books there about these journeys. And one of the things that keeps coming up is web to print. There are these storefronts that enable this on the web. Customers can go on and they can pick a coffee mug or a business card and they can put the graphics on themselves, order it, and make all of that happen on a web storefront. And I started asking questions of people at HP and internally about doing that. What would it take in order to put boxes one day on a website and have somebody be able to do that? Do we even think customers would be interested in that? What are the challenges to putting a three-dimensional box up on a site? Because all the stuff that we had seen was pretty much a two-dimensional print item. Really, from those visits to HP, Dave and Dave turned down one investment in a larger press.
You came back and they had said no.
Yeah, that would have been 13 because we ended up buying the next generation press in 14. And so now we're up to 40.
They weren't running from it. They just probably needed to see a few more things, a little bit more business need, which
continued
is what you
growth.
Were talking about, some of those areas that you started to explore as other avenues.
Right. But if you're looking at contribution in the corrugated plant, let's say that the brown box plant is writing 30% contribution, this stuff's showing up at 50, 60% contribution. Now you can start to say, wow, if this actually ever became a significant part of our business, this could be really meaningful to the company. More and more customers are buying it. The order sizes are getting larger. I figure out with a young guy at the company who had worked for one of the large commercial printers that web to print probably would work. At the time, he was working as a sales assistant. Boy, did we have him in the wrong role. He told me that he wanted to go to code school. I was like, what's that? He says, I want to go learn to be a developer. And I said, can you do that with us? Can we send you to code school? And he's like, why would you do that? I said, I don't know. I think I need somebody who can do this and write workflow automation and put our digital business on one of these web to print storefronts. And now I bring in my IT manager, Mike Betker, and the three of us start having this conversation about this potential website. I don't even mention it to Dave and Dave at this point because it's like too far from any kind of reality. And we determined that it's possible, right? We also have, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Darren Newport, our current design manager. Darren figured out how to automate standards. So to create the ability for a box to be immediately designed to size and rendered on the website. And I had not heard of anybody doing that prior to him showing me that he could. And eventually I put a business plan together. I go to Dave and I say, I want to build a website like Vistaprint, but for boxes. And they're like, okay, what would that do? So we'd reach all these other customers. So we could get outside of our region potentially, could accelerate the digital business. My guess is we could sell it for a premium. All kinds of different potential reasons that it's a win. And it's been successful in all these other industries. And Dave and Dave are generally very simple guys, one page or two pages, nothing more than that. So I had to boil all of my ideas down to two pages, showed a couple of websites on there in these other industries. And they said, how much is it going to cost to build? I said, I think it's going to cost about $65,000 to build. Actually, what I said was, I think it's going to cost about the same as a salary for a rookie sales rep for a year. And they said, okay, how much do you think it's going to sell? More than a rookie sales rep in the first year.
Sold.
Yeah. They're like, okay. And as was their style, by the way, as partners, they said, okay, why don't you take off for a little bit and we'll chat about it and then we'll come back to you. And so they talked about it themselves. And then they invited me back in later that day. And they said, you don't really know what it is you're going to do, but we like the idea. And yeah, go ahead. So Fantastipak was born out of that and went live in the fall of 2015.
You clearly had to have had some immediate success with Fantastipak and the way that got out of the gate, because shortly thereafter, that's when you went after the PageWide. And if our listeners haven't seen a high-speed digital machine, the first time I saw the PageWide, I was just blown away with the scale and the size. That's a significant investment for you, for the company. Explain that. Explain how that conversation went. Was that, at the time, the biggest investment you guys had made? And we talked a little bit about risk before. Where were you at in terms of your risk level?
Yeah, we had success. So Fantastipak launches in September of 15. And then it's like watching paint dry. I'm waiting for somebody to order something, right? I have no idea if this is going to work. And it's a week later, Coffee Cult in Florida pays $1,000 for 200 mailers for their coffee subscription business shipped to Florida. And I like jumped to the moon and back, because
couldn't it be,
it was everything,
couldn't be
all
more
at once.
Geographically what you're looking for outside your market.
They found us, they could order, they paid for it up front, it shipped all the way across the country, the order came in and we could produce it and get it out on time. They didn't ask for any credit, nothing went wrong. So we became firm believers in the potential of web to print for the corrugated business. I should say, while we were building ours, two others came to market. So there wasn't anything that we knew about when we started to build Fantastipak. But that took about 7 months to build. And in that time, Packlane and Packable came to the market. There's some young kids out of San Francisco that wanted to disrupt the packaging industry, and they created web-to-print sites. We ended up being the producer for a lot of those boxes because they didn't want to be in the box business. They just wanted to disrupt it. We started having success. Dave and I go to Israel. We placed an order for the 17,000. So now you're at 140 sheets an hour. You could run a couple million square feet a month if you do it right. This is starting to be a real business. We have more than $1 million in revenue at this point digitally. And as we're getting ready to leave from Israel, they ask us if we're interested in seeing the future of their corrugated equipment, like what they think is really going to be the first significant investment of theirs into really being suited for corrugated. And so Dave and I sign an NDA, and we get introduced to this guy, Evyatar, who takes us into the secure site and shows us a very early rudimentary version of the print engine that would become the print engine in the C500. And he explains to us some of the features and the speeds and the size. And Dave and I left that trip thinking, that's it. That's the game changer right there. And so we come back and we tell Hill that we bought the 17,000, which wasn't part of our plan when we went there. And by the way, we also want to put a letter of intent on one of these new things that is probably far off in the distant future. And we decided to do it. We put an LOI on the C500. As it turned out, we owned like the second position for one of those things for the US for a while there. And the 17,000 came and it was highly successful for us. And these investments are now you're starting to invest $1 million or $2 million at a time, because as more printing capacity comes, you have to have more cutting capacity. And there's a whole conversation to have about cutting capacity, because a basic CAD table was not a production device. But ESCO brings the XPA. So now you have a feeder and a takeoff on a cutter. Then Zund comes with dual axis with faster feeding and takeoff. And we ordered that sight unseen. We didn't even get a chance to see it. We just ordered the first one. They're still running in our plant. We have serial number 0, came out of the lab. And we have serial number 0 for the next generation of that. And it's almost the same with laser. Yeah, it's now Fantastipak and other web-to-print businesses are growing. We become known as a place that can produce this stuff. And now we start getting asked if we would produce it for some of these other sites. And because they're not in the corrugated business and they're in the software and technology business, they start talking to us about these things like APIs. And we're like, what's an API? And I remember thinking, man, I am the wrong person to be sitting in this room having this conversation. I need to get somebody in here that has a lot more knowledge about technology. And to get that young guy, Taylor, and Michael, our IT manager, in. They start talking, oh yeah, APIs. Okay, we know what that is. And we ended up building our first set of APIs to connect PacLane's website to us so that they could place orders automatically. And now we're investing in automation in the workflow. How do we get all these orders? We're starting to get now hundreds of orders a day. And how do you deal with graphics and layouts and nesting them and getting them to the press? And we start realizing that like, we have to really automate all of this. Otherwise, you're going to be adding tons of people. And there's not going to be an economic win if we have to add a lot of people to handle all of these orders. The order size is too small. So that's also when the software investments start to occur and we start turning to become more of a technology-driven company.
When does the C500 show up?
The first C500 showed up the end of 17, came into Kent, Washington, and we ran the first sheet on or around the first of the year. And I still have photographs proud in my office of the first sheet that came off from that press. It was the third U.S. press chief in Atlanta, and then Company Box in Charlotte, and then ourselves. And they were all in about 10-week span that HP did the beginning installation.
Not only do you have Fantastipak rolling for you, you're manufacturing for other companies. You've got this workflow. This is obviously taking off with what you did on the 17,000 was that machine? And then the page wide, like you were talking about, as 19 starts coming around, what percentage has your business shifted now? Is it overtaking Brown Box yet, or is it just getting meaningful? What's the mix?
It's the compound annual growth rate on the digital business for the first, 7-8 years is like 150%.
Wow. Jeez.
So now you're starting to have growth of more than $1 million a year, or to $2 million a year. I think it was just before COVID, I went to an AICC event, and that was the first time that I expressed in public that we were doing more revenue digitally than we were with Brown Box. So that would have been around 19.
I was at that event.
1920.
Was in Kansas City. So as this has grown, you guys start to branch out a little bit. You start looking at acquisition opportunities. Walk us through how you identified and thought maybe some acquisitive growth now that we're becoming such a meaningful player in this space is going to make sense for Boxmaker and how you and the partners reach that conclusion.
You would end each year. So web to print has a huge peak season, much more than even just our normal corrugated seasonality. From, I don't know, from Halloween to December, just hold on. It could be 4 or 5x very quickly. And so we had all these years in a row from really 16 through 19 where we could not make enough of this stuff. You could not get enough capacity. You couldn't get enough out of it. We're running 24/7, running as automated as we can. And so it's at the end of 19. We've had another one of these giant years. We've got the C500 has been running for 2 full years. And yet we have another year where we end the year with thousands of orders past due because we just couldn't get them out.
Wow.
And also we realize now most of these shipments are way outside the Northwest. A very small percentage of the business is geographically near the plant. So that's good. But at the same time, Dave Taylor would say, I think it's easier for us to ship to Japan than it is to some of these customers. And so we start talking about added capacity again, and we're on this treadmill that you really can't get off. You just got to keep adding more and more capacity, chase the growth. And we realize that it doesn't make sense to add more capacity in the Northwest. And now the company's going to have to do something that is significantly different than we've done, which is to add a manufacturing site somewhere distant from our hub. And we start talking about a greenfield in Cincinnati based on just shipping lanes and where talent is. So we come to an agreement that it makes sense to invest in another plant. Initially, we're thinking about taking, we now have a 15,500 printer in addition to a 17,000. We have a fleet of CAD machines. And we start thinking about taking some of this equipment and relocating it to Cincinnati or to the east, setting up a greenfield plant. We'll continue to run the majority of the volume in Seattle because that's where the C500 press is and the die cutters and the gluers. But while all of this is going on, COVID happens. Daniel Dixon, our director of operations, and I start having a conversation about how the two of us are going to be living in a trailer outside of a greenfield plant in Cincinnati during COVID for what? A year and a half to hire everybody, get all the equipment put in, develop a culture, get everything running well. This is not like I go steal somebody from another box plant. The digital is a different animal. And Daniel makes the very astute observation that we'd be better off buying one of the other digital plants or something like that. And one of the earlier adopters, a lot of people who were thinking about getting into digital would ask if they could come and visit us in Seattle. And I went to a lot of these events and I would speak at different functions. And so I met a lot of people through that. And two of the people I had met, John and Steve, started Tango Press in Arkansas. And I had stayed in touch with them. This would be my version of it. But I knew that they didn't want to keep investing on the treadmill. They had grown that business, but it needed a lot more equipment and a lot more investment to grow. And so we ended up having a conversation with them and made the decision to acquire Tango Press, which we did at the end of 20, or yeah, at the beginning of 20, and immediately started investing in a new facility to be built to suit there just outside of Bentonville, and ordered a second C500 and all the other equipment, and started that whole process of building our Lowell, Arkansas plant.
What was that like in the early days of merging two cultures, and now you're on an airplane probably more than you have been, yeah, trying to get this integrated while at the same time moving it, expanding it?
During COVID?
Good point, Joe.
Yeah. It wasn't as challenging as it might sound. John Ballantyne stayed, which was great. We wanted John to stay. And really what we were wanting to do was carry out a merging of John's vision for his business and our business together with this new plant. And John was going to lead, or did lead, our trade business. He was really good at calling on the industry, and that's what they had done at Tango Press. And I could count on John, and he had a good team. There were 13 people that came with the acquisition. Pretty much everybody stayed in that initial phase. And John knew of a builder, and the builder had a piece of property that was close to the FedEx facility. And we use FedEx currently for all of the web to print shipments. And so it made sense to us to get as close proximity to a FedEx parcel and freight facility as we could. So we get last pickup in the day. And so things just started to come together. I really liked the builder. The proposal for the building made sense. We had some drawings done. You go through that whole process. I think one of the things that was surprising was, I think the building that John was in, I don't know, 12,000 square feet.
It was a small little building.
Yeah. And we thought we were going to need 30,000 square feet. The building that we ended up building is 64,000 square feet. And we've only been there 2 years, and there are days that I think, man, we really should have done a bigger building. And we just had a lot of learnings from Kent, from all the digital. We relocated digital so many times in Kent because the thing was growing that fast. And we could do a layout that was a lot more efficient with all of that learning, and then think a little bit about what we knew was coming. We knew laser was coming. We anticipated that there would be continued movement in CAD. And so we just wanted to do our best to build a plant that suited our needs in that time, and then also for years to come. And I think we did that. And then also, I would say we needed a plant manager eventually to lead that new plant. And we were swamped with candidates. We had an amazing outpouring of people interested. And we ended up with some finalists that included Todd Tipton, who John knew, had worked in the SMC organization, and really wanted just a new chapter in his life and to be part of a digital business. And so we ended up hiring Todd, and he's been a fantastic hire for us, really leading that new plant and helped make a lot of the final decisions so that the plant would be, you know, better organized and run more efficiently than we had even imagined.
Around the same time, and maybe I'm a little off on the timeline, but you also brought on board another seasoned corrugated guy in Brett to run the sales side of things. Is that correct?
Yeah. Just as the plant is beginning to open, John Ballantyne makes a decision to spend more time with his family. And really hard decision, I think, for John and for us. But I'm happy for him because it's worked out really well for him and for us. John tells me this news. I'm thinking, man, we're investing well over $10 million to open this new plant. And web to print is going to be a big part of what goes on there. But I'm counting on John and to grow the trade business and really be a key leader there in Arkansas. I didn't think that I would have to now be in Arkansas a significant amount of the time. I didn't want to do that just because there's a lot of requirements on my time in Kent. And I called Dave Taylor and I said, hey, I have some bad news. John's decided to not be with us soon. He's going to spend more time with his family and build a house and do some other things. And Dave says, sorry to hear that. What did Brett say? I go, Brett. He goes, yeah. And it dawns on me. I go, I'll call you back. I called Brett Kirkpatrick because Brett had been, we knew Brett for years from Bay Cities. He had been on some of the HP trips, and we had visited him and Greg and Sahar and the group there at Bay Cities several times and did some work together. But at that time, Brett was no longer with Bay Cities, and he was looking for his next opportunity. So I call him up and I say, hey, I think I got something for you, but I don't know that it's all what you're looking for, because it's to lead our trade business. And Brett had led a lot of things in his career, but not necessarily his sales. And so we have about 10 days to get Brett to be interested, get him an offer, get him signed on, and get him a transition a couple of days with John. And all of that happened. So I think I was on a plane like 3 days after John told me, because I figured I needed to go at least sell Brett what it was we were planning to do. And yeah, and that has worked out really well. Brett is a fantastic member of our executive team. He's grown the trade business tremendously, executed on the vision that we have for it, and he's going to continue to do that for years to come. There's a real opportunity for us continues to be in serving the trade, because people either want what digital is capable of that's different than what's in their plant, or they don't want to make these investments themselves. And I understand that. There's generational change that goes on in this equipment. It doesn't come in like a Flexo and stay in your building for 20 plus years. There's a lot of workflow and technology that needs to be invested in to do this efficiently. And I think that a lot of our AICC friends recognize that they're not buying the equipment might be the easy part. And so they why not just buy a turnkey item or a pre-printed sheet from us?
What one kind of takeaway for our listeners, where do you see, like you said, just this, you're in a technology space that evolves very rapidly. If you had to crystal ball your opinion, where do you see this thing in 15 years and what's the evolution? And are you bullish still about the space?
Yeah, I should say in our label business, we had 2 8-color Flexos. We no longer produce anything Flexo in the label business. Everything is digital. And it has been for a couple of years. So we've already seen that happen in pressure-sensitive labels where, you know, 97% of our orders were best suited to digital production, because that crossover point, the addressable order size and the efficiency keeps moving up and to the right with each generation of press.
Yeah.
And so now you have to have a bigger, a larger order to really have it make sense versus running digitally. The same has been happening in the corrugated side. Most of us with single pass presses are now running up to truckload orders or multi-truckload orders at times, especially if you have a lot of versions. You've got BHS and I think others that are looking at or bringing to market a digital print directly with or on the corrugator. You've got print heads that can be retrofitted onto Flexos. So you're using a digital print jetting onto the box instead of plates in the print section. And I think all of that just continues on going forward, because the efficiencies involved in digital production make sense. I've converted a lot of Flexo business over to digital, not because it's 6-color high graphics. There's a lot of 3-color work that we no longer produce Flexo, simply because the setup time and the waste when we're doing it doesn't pay. I'm better off using that time to run something more efficient. And I have this fantastic efficient printer that the customer always likes what the print looks like.
Yeah.
I don't have any conversations about traps or bad print quality. And I think that when more corrugated producers have an opportunity to see that type of an impact in their business, that's going to now bring another generation of investment into digital. But I don't see Flexo or other technologies in corrugated going away anytime soon. I just think that more and more of the investment will be in digital, and digital will continue to evolve the capabilities of the machines, the sizes, the efficiency of the ink. I think all of those things will continue to progress, and it'll get harder and harder for analog to make sense. And at some point, I think within 15 years, I think you said, Gene, I think there will be many plants that no longer have Flexo printing going on in their facility at that point. They might have a Flexo, but it's just taking a pre-printed sheet and finishing it.
Where do you see this? Where do you see this industry progressing? You're advancing digital. Its flexibility capability is very impressive. I think there's new technology, a set wall run coming out on the direct print side. Where do you see customers, users, consumers taking us as suppliers and what we're going to have to face in the next 5 to 10 years?
The first thing, when people ask me, industry friends, about digital, I try to help them understand getting the equipment is the easy part. It's the workflow and the mindset, the it's just very different than making boxes in a more traditional or analog fashion. And it's at so many different touch points too. But that goes to what's different ahead. We now have clients who have completely reshaped their supply chain based on digital production. And I don't think they'll ever go back. So, you know, you take a client that they have a service business, they service equipment. And when they sell this equipment into their customer base, they have to agree to service it for 20 years. Now, they don't know in any particular year how many units they're going to service from 2003, 2005, 2010, whatever. So I have 100 SKUs of boxes and interior packaging that I run in a Flexo-based economic order quantity. I might run 200 of a SKU, and some other SKUs might be 10,000. But that, let's take that one that's 200. They might only service 5 of those machines this year, 3 next year, 1 the following year, and then it's sunsetting. So at the end, I've got a conversation with them. I've been holding the inventory for the better part of 2 years from a teeny little, I don't even run a pallet on the Flexo, but I've got it in a warehouse. I pick it as they need it and ship it over. And there's an obsolescence conversation that every year is well over 6 figures. Okay. And so now in the last year, we've gone to that client and we said, how long into the, when you get an order from your customer, how far ahead of the box need is that? They said, oh, that's probably 2 weeks ahead. How does it come into you? Does it come in on a electronic form? Do they go to a website? Do they call somebody? It can take a variety of different forms, but it ultimately gets entered into their system that a service is going to take place. And that's before the item ships in from somewhere in the world to be serviced. And I said, if you could tell me when you get that service call, that initiation of an order, that this unit is coming in, I can relate it to a box and an interior pack, and I can make that in real time and deliver it to your line when you need it. And we can eliminate all of the inventory, all of the obsolescence. And the customer is just sitting there like they can't imagine that's possible. They have a warehouse filled. I have a warehouse filled. This has been going on for 20 plus years with this account. Everybody just writes these checks. And the supply chain is actually changing to digital. We're actually doing what I described. And the client loves it. They're paying a little bit more per item, typically, because you're running short run. But it's going through this automated workflow. Gene, you've seen it in person, having been to the plants. I don't have anybody touching those orders until it's out of press. That's the first person who knows. So there's no design or customer service or pre-production or anything from a labor standpoint on those orders. And you can then take it to another client who's buying litho-lam in large quantities. They have 52 versions of their litho-lam box. Eight copies are laid out together. Joe, do all 8 sell at the same rate on a regular basis? No. Let's say they're pies. Invariably, they're calling me and asking if they can run the Marion barrier separate from everything else, right? And I don't know, I've got them all ganged together and now I have to break those apart. In digital, we don't do that at all. We just tell them, sure, we'll run whatever quantity you want and you tell us how many of each version. Very simple to do. And they've eliminated an offsite warehouse. They've eliminated their version of obsolescence. They order every 2 weeks based on what they sold for the last 2 weeks. That's the order with us. They're going to replenish to their inventory just 2 weeks worth of product, and it's what they sold. They're no longer buying to a projected plan, which most of those are not that great. But it's just, that's the stuff that I think is going to eventually drive much more adoption into digital. People get hung up on all the personalization and the variable print. We're a big proponent of that too, and it'll have its place. But I think it's the supply chain efficiencies and the elimination of the obsolescence. I think it's within your box plant that you can run more efficiently once you figure out that you don't clog this machine with some difficult three-color job that you have high waist, high setup, and low run speed. And instead, you have it come from a digital press, and now you run that at full speed in finishing. It's really changed the way that we run our business and the way we interact with customers. And I think that's what's going to really support the continued digitization, if you will, of corrugated.
That's great. As we get to the end of the podcast here, you've touched on a few people, but I think it's worth circling back. As you look back on a very impressive career, who are those people that have blessed you with their knowledge and their time and talent to help make a better Richard that you really tip your cap to?
Certainly my dad, in hindsight, an amazing gesture by my dad. And then Gene Shelton and Al Richter, leaders of the businesses that I worked for. I didn't mention it earlier, but Al Richter, it was a fairly small business, really. It was only in the West Coast. And Al launched something similar to our Arkansas investment. He built a huge foam plant in Visalia, California. And it was a major undertaking for a small business. And so I saw risk taking at a significant level, right? That was really an important thing to be part of and would come around later. All the folks that have been mentors and leaders through time, certainly in the forefront, Dave Hill and Dave Taylor. Dave Hill was just always so good with me, so patient. I could ask him about anything. We would have very good foundational conversations. He was brilliant at asking questions. Sometimes it drove me nuts.
Yeah.
Because he would have six questions on how the digital ink got laid down on the paper the way that it did. And I was a little bit more, I don't know. I just know I can sell it. Again, teaching me to be more inquisitive and dig under the covers. And Taylor, when Mr. Hill passed and we turned, he gave me the opportunity to turn my phantom position into a real equity position. And I've continued to have the opportunity to add equity over the last few years. And he's just incredibly giving and a lot of fun. Dave's in his early 70s and here he still has the appetite to go off and do something like we did in Arkansas. A lot of people would be ready to say, hey, I want to get my exit plan together and not do an investment like this. Yeah, they've been key. And then Linda all the way along. I give her a little tongue-in-cheek difficulty about being my sales manager, but she's the one. And my current team, my executive team that work with me all the time, they know that she's the one who's really behind the scenes helping me be a nicer, kinder steward of the business and understand the office environment much better than I normally want to.
Gene usually asks this question, but maybe I'll jump in. If you could say one thing to the younger generation that's trying to make a name for themselves within their organization or start their own business.
I would say to try and learn the things that come before and after the job that you're currently doing. That paid off big time for Linda and I, and I give that advice to coworkers that are asking me how to advance at the box maker. Like I have a C500 pressman right now who is interested in what's next in his path. And I said, well, you're either going to have to go to graphics or go to die cutting, because those are the things that come before and after what you're currently doing. And the more you get, more knowledge you get about those things, the more you know about the chain of events, the more valuable you are, even if it's remaining at your current role. You're just going to bring more perspective to it. That's going to be seen. Just keep doing the work. And most of the time, I had a lot of initiative over the years, but I had people maybe identifying me as a person that had that initiative, as opposed to being somebody screaming out all the time for that next role.
Yeah. As we wrap, just hearing your story, first of all, thank you for sharing it. I think it's had an amazing career. What would you tell young Richard Brown walking into the arranged marriage that pushed him out of his dad's business way back when you were at Master Paperbox in a trailer out back of Landsberg? What would you tell him looking back, the wins, the losses, maybe the lessons learned?
I guess in that time, I'd probably tell him, don't worry. Your choice to not be an anesthesiologist is going to work out okay. The box or packaging business has been incredibly good to me and my family. I met my wife, Linda, at Landsberg. That wouldn't even happen if I didn't go to work there. My life would be incredibly different in that regard. But I think that I learned it from Dave Hill, but it was always there for me. And I think that what I would probably want to verbalize to my younger self is that pursuit of doing something different. At each position that I had, I always wanted to do something slightly different than what was already being done. And early on, that shows up in some organizations as you're a pain. You're difficult. Why can't you just sell what we already have or make what we already have? But if I'd had the confidence that it would work out the way that it would at an earlier age, I probably would have pursued it with more passion early on. So yeah. That's the advice that I would give myself at that age.
That's great.
Yeah, I think we've interviewed a number of people now over the last 2 years, primarily in the traditional corrugated space, Richard, and certainly they've all taken risks and they've all taken those leaps of faith in their own businesses respectively. But I'd say talking to you, you're a pioneer in that digital space, and compliments on you on building something from that idea that you had in your mind on day one. It's really impressive, and congratulations on all you've done.
Thank you. I've appreciated the opportunity. Thank you so much. The AICC specifically, because that's a lot of the audience here, been a member since I joined Boxmaker and have always appreciated the opportunity other AICC members and associate members have given to me. And really within the CEO groups, that's just another group. I didn't mention them specifically earlier, but both friends, mentors, the people asking you the tough question that maybe somebody else won't, telling you you're crazy. And then you decide whether you agree with them or not. And then we all collectively look at it in the rearview mirror and go, hey, that was a great idea. Yeah. I was on board for that, wasn't I?
Remember when I told you what a great idea that was back when?
But yeah, the association specifically has been great as well.
Breaking down boxes.
New shows will drop the first Monday of every month.
Remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts.